Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Welcome to The Roy Green Show podcast.
I want to start the program today, and we're going to start it this way. I want you to listen to this. So you may be asking what I'm doing. Well, I'm going to ask our first guest why the bells are ringing. And our first guest is Israel's ambassador to Canada, Ambassador Ido Moed, is back with us on the program. Mr. Ambassador, thank you for the time. And what's the significance of the bells today?
Thank you very much, Roy, for having me on your show again. I appreciate this bell ringing, because it is to remind us that today we mark 100 days since the 7th of October massacre. 100 days have passed, and we still have 136 abductees kept in horrendous conditions in Gaza. They are there without us knowing what is their fate. We have no idea how they're held. We know that from testimonies that they are abused. And it's just horrific. The 1,200 people who died in that massacre and their memory needs to be relived. We are at war with a terrorist organization called Hamas. And we do hope that we will not have to have such days as today to commemorate. We want our people back, and we want this war to end. But Hamas needs to be eliminated.
Yeah, Mr. Ambassador, we've been hearing news stories today that family members of hostages and Israeli citizens have been demonstrating in Israel and demanding the hostages be released, demanding that the government and the Prime Minister Netanyahu get this accomplished. Could you speak to that?
The very broad public in Israel supports the government in its war against Hamas, but at the same time, as we hear of the fate of the hostages from the testimonies of those who were liberated, the pressure among the people of Israel is mounting. These people need to be released. 136 people, young and old, children, men and women, are held in who knows where conditions. They are starved, they are abused, there are stories of rape and other horrendous crimes. So the public wants to air their concern and their yearning for their release. And so the government is working and is doing its utmost. The military pressure on Hamas, we know that that also bears fruit, but we have to keep it up. And that's why public speaks up.
Okay. So even though the public in Israel is protesting or massing and demonstrating, they are still supportive of the government and the initiative by Prime Minister Netanyahu, who said as well that Israel will continue its mission to destroy Hamas regardless of opposition, including by international courts. And we know that story. I'll talk to you about that in just a moment. But the people of Israel are still strongly behind Mr. Netanyahu.
They are very strong behind the war. It's a very broad government right now, and so we can easily say that the broad public is, all of it is in support of the government and is in support of this war against terrorism, against this source of evil that was inflicted on us. And we, once that is dealt with, perhaps other things will evolve politically. But that is not what we are focusing on. We are focusing on winning this war.
So the South African charge at the United Nations International Court of Justice was that, or continues to be, that Israel is guilty of genocide. And United States and other countries have absolutely refused to accept that premise. The Prime Minister took until this past Friday, with Mr. Trudeau saying only, and I quote, "Our wholehearted support of the ICJ and its processes does not mean that we support the premise of the case brought forward by South Africa." Ambassador Moed, to me, that's not a complete rejection of South Africa's case against Israel before the International Court of Justice. Seems to me to be a lukewarm support from Mr. Trudeau of Israel at best.
Well, I think at the same time, the message from Canada is very clear about the support for Israel's right to exist and to defend itself in accordance with international law. This is exactly what we are doing. When it comes to the International Court of Justice, we see that countries are very careful with the way they formulate their messaging, but it is clear that there is no genocide. Also from Canadian perspective, there is no genocide. And I think this is very important to note, that the international community does not see merit in this case means that it's a politicization of a legal instrument that was cynically enough brought into place following the worst crime of humanity against another people, and that is the Holocaust. And so weaponizing this against the very people who are now victims of another effort to eliminate the people of Israel is very cynical. And so in that sense, it's very important that Canada came out with a statement. Yes, we would have preferred it to be stronger. Of course, we would have, and that is clear. But at the same time, it is very important that Canada makes this statement about not accepting the premise of this case, because that means that the accusation of genocide doesn't really stand.
Yeah, several Liberal Party members of Parliament, I'm not going to ask you to get into domestic politics, but we do have several Liberal Party members of Parliament publicly siding with South Africa, and five Liberal and New Democrat members of Parliament traveling to the West Bank, and several signed on to a ceasefire demand. That seemed... Do you understand that when people are doing that, particularly since there was a ceasefire in effect on October the 7th?
Yes, exactly. Ceasefire existed, as you very rightly noted, until October the 6th, and Hamas broke it. They broke another ceasefire when we created the humanitarian pause, and they will continue to do it again and again. So there is no reason to believe that Hamas can be any partner in anything in this issue. And so the calls for ceasefire, I think that in many ways are, and we said that also in the ICJ, in the International Court of Justice very clearly, are there to support Hamas in their efforts to regroup and to rearm itself and to continue their assault against Israel. And that is of course something that we will not accept. We have to defend ourselves against this ongoing threat, and we have to make sure that's eliminated. But what is also very important to note in the context of this blood libel that was put in place by South Africa is that what Israel is doing and has been doing very clearly from the outset is making sure that everybody knows that it's doing its utmost to keep any people who are not involved out of harm's way. I must stress, for Israel, any victim, any death is a tragedy. It doesn't matter if it's an Israeli or Palestinian. But when these people are innocent bystanders, there is no reason why they should die. The only reason that this is happening is because Hamas initiated a war against Israel and against the Jewish people to annihilate it. So it's a war that was forced upon us, and we have to fight back. And it's very unfortunate that there are victims in this. We are trying our utmost to warn people to stay out of harm's way. We inform them directly by phones, by leaflets, millions of leaflets that were dropped over the Gaza Strip, and by calling them and by making sure that they understand where are the safe places to go. And actually, we even protected many people in Gaza against Hamas by putting tanks in place to allow for people to move from one part of the Gaza Strip to another, because we knew that Hamas would attack them. So we want to make sure that when we are fighting Hamas, at least as people are hurt as possible, and at the same time also facilitate the flow of international aid and support for those who need it within the Gaza Strip.
All right.
It's an extremely complicated process, but we are doing that. We are working very hard to make sure that that happens all the time.
We're just talking, Mr. Ambassador, about the visuals of innocent civilians, dead, children wounded, children killed. And I just received an email from a listener saying that he's very supportive of Israel, but he's asking the question, shouldn't Israel's world-class military be more surgical in its operations against Hamas?
Good question. I think the answer to that is in the time that Israel has taken to prepare for the operation in Gaza, which was 3 weeks from 7th of October until we started the operation. The 3 weeks have passed in our preparations. We have enough munition and power to really raise gas very quickly, but we prepared because we knew this is going to be very complicated. And as it turns out to be, I think the most complicated warfare, urban earth warfare ever fought anywhere around the world. And so we are very meticulous. We have divided the Gaza Strip into small parcels of land where we inform the inhabitants of a specific area in advance that there is an incoming attack, so they will be able to move away. We inform them in time so that they have time to go elsewhere. We inform people where they can find water and shelter. We work very closely on a daily basis with the international organizations, the United Nations and others, to make sure that these safe passages are, as far as we are concerned, guaranteed. And we try to inform people by calling them on the phone to tell them, listen, get out of the house, out of harm's way. We know you are not involved. So we are doing whatever we can. And I don't think that in the past any government or military has made so many efforts to protect the local population from our own attacks, because we understand that we have to do that. That's our duty. And this is also what a very broad population of Israel believes. Palestinians will be our future neighbors. They are our neighbors now. And we have to find ways also to think about the future of this conflict. And the future will be some form of coexistence, which we'll have to have after we establish sufficient security guarantees. But that is the process that we'll have to work on after we complete the eradication of Hamas.
What are the threats now, Mr. Ambassador, do you think of a wider war developing in the region? We have the Houthis attacking shipping in the Red Sea and Iran-backed militias attacking U.S. military posts in Iraq and southern Syria, resulting in two U.S. bombing and missile assaults on the Houthis, one mission including British fighter jets attacking Houthi missile sites and radar locations. At some point, is Iran going to be held accountable, because they're behind all of this? They fund and they provide the weapons to these orchid groups like the Houthis.
Absolutely agreed. Iran has to be accountable for what is happening, what's transpiring in the region. They have tens of proxies they are fighting this war through. So it's the Hezbollah in Lebanon that has killed today a mother and son in the north of Israel by shooting a rocket grenade from Lebanon into Israel, into a civilian village called Kfar Yuval. They are responsible for arming and training the Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and the likes. They are coordinating on a constant basis with those organizations. They are traveling into the region. They are meeting them in Beirut and elsewhere in Damascus. And they are the ones that are behind the Houthis. And when people understand that their scope of reach is not just Israel, but their missiles reach far beyond Central Europe and the U.S., you understand that actually this country poses a threat to not only to the Middle East, but far beyond. So Iran should be held accountable for what...
So how do you see that happening? Because this is the time, this 100 days of war between Israel and Hamas. Iran supplies, funds Hamas, similarly Hezbollah and the Houthis. But we have about a minute, Mr. Ambassador. Isn't this the time? Wouldn't this be the perfect time to really hold Iran accountable? They're killing their own people.
Absolutely agree with that. It has to happen through the United Nations. It has to happen through any other international platform, be it ICJ or elsewhere, where Iran needs to be held accountable for their crimes and their complicity in the crimes and their instigating of these horrendous war crimes and crimes against humanity and genocide. They've stated again and again that they will erase Israel from the map. So I think that this is the time to call on the international community to come together with a very strong statement to Iran to stop their horrendous and fatal efforts to eradicate Israel from the map and actually to inflict harm to the free world. This is a war about values, and this is a war about our freedom.
David Milgaard, I want to talk about David Milgaard for a second before we talk to our guest who knew David very well. I knew David somewhat. David Milgaard was charged with murder when he was a teenager in the death of a nurse in Saskatchewan. The actual killer was right there for the police to grab, but it would have meant a little work. So they didn't do the work. David was available, so they grabbed him and they charged him, and he was convicted and he was sent to prison as a teen. Many of you will remember the story because it was David's mother, Joyce, who confronted Prime Minister Brian Mulroney in a very public arena and alerted him to her son's great injustice. By then, he'd spent, I think, close to 20 years in prison for a murder he did not commit. All thanks to Brian Mulroney, because Mr. Mulroney pursued it. And eventually, this ponderous, self-congratulatory justice system in this country had to admit that a great travesty had been committed and David Milgaard had been imprisoned when he was innocent. After 15 years, justice officials went to David and said, look, just admit you've done it. Just admit to the murder and we'll let you go. We'll get your parole. And David Milgaard said, no, I did not commit the murder. I'm not going to say I did. So he spent another total of an additional eight years of his life in prison. 23 years in total. So through Joyce, his mother, I got to know David a bit, and over the years after he was released, we would talk both on and off the air. And I don't know what Tom and Matt in the studio have selected, but I asked them to find a clip of David Milgaard on this program. David died. It's about a year and a half ago now, 2 years ago. I asked them to find a clip of David just talking to us. Play it, guys.
In my situation, there was a serial rapist that was responsible for the crime, and that information was available for people to see and should have been disclosed by the prosecution, and had it been even disclosed prior to my appeals in the Saskatchewan Appeal Court, I would have been released.
Yeah. Larry Miller was the killer. Oh, yeah, they convicted him after David had spent his 23 years in prison. We talked to Rob Baltovich on this program two, three years ago. He was convicted of murdering his girlfriend. Police took the easy way out. Crown took the easy way out. He was convicted. He went to prison. Eventually, through Innocence Canada, he was found not guilty. So this past week, two men, Robert Bobby Mailman and Walter Wally Gillespie of New Brunswick, who were convicted on May the 11th, 1984, in the murder of George Lehman in November of 1983, were acquitted of the crime and released from prison. By the way, both men had strong alibis, with multiple witnesses placing them kilometers from the crime scene on the day of the murder. Mr. Mailman is 76. Now, he served 18 years in prison and he's terminally ill. Mr. Gillespie is 80 years of age and he spent 21 years of his life sentence in prison. Wait till you hear what the Crown did when they appeared before the Chief Justice in St. John. Wait till you hear what the Crown did. Ron Dalton is our guest. Ron is the president of Innocence Canada, which intervened on behalf of Mr. Mailman and Mr. Gillespie and worked to gain their freedom, as Innocence Canada has done for others, including David Milgaard. Ron was also convicted of murdering his wife. And that was medical incompetence and justice incompetence. And Ron was eventually and correctly found innocent and was released from prison. How are you, Ron?
I'm well, Roy.
Everything I said, do you take issue with anything I've said?
No, it brings a tear to my eye, but I don't take issue with any of it.
Yeah, how could it not? You know, when I'm just thinking just about you now. So Robert, Bobby Mailman, and Wally Gillespie, 76 and 80 respectively now, spent 18 and 21 years in prison respectively. And you spent, was it 12 years?
12 years start to finish.
12 years start to finish.
I was 34 years ago, Roy, I was actually serving a life sentence alongside these two gentlemen.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And that was a couple of years before Innocence Canada or predecessor Aidwick was even started. So this is one of our longest outstanding cases, but it's a very personal case for me.
Who were they? Can you tell us a bit about Mr. Mailman and Mr. Gillespie?
Mr. Mailman had a little bit of a criminal record. He was known as a local thug, had some armed robbery charges, but he had beaten several criminal cases, serious cases, in courts in St. John. There were three Superior Court judges in St. John, New Brunswick, 40 years ago. Bobby had been in front of all three of them within a 10-month period and had been acquitted of all of the various charges. These guys wanted him off of the street. They didn't particularly care what for. So when Mr. Lehman's body was found, they didn't care that Mr. Mailman or Mr. Gillespie had solid alibis, weren't in the area. They didn't care that they were paying witnesses to testify against them. They didn't care that witnesses recanted several times to police officers, prosecution, journalists and others. They put all of that aside and they just went full steam ahead to get Mr. Mailman off of the street. Mr. Gillespie happened to be hanging around with him on the day that they came looking for him. Mr. Gillespie, 2 days after he was arrested, was offered a chance to take a 2 to 3 year sentence as an accessory if he would point the finger at Mr. Mailman. Mr. Gillespie, solid guy that he was, said, "I can't say I saw something that I didn't see." It cost him 40 years of his life.
That's
the bulk of his life, really, because the man is 80 years old.
Yeah.
He's living in a bed sitting room now. He until a week ago when we went to court in front of the Chief Justice and had acquittals entered for both men, Mr. Gillespie was living in a halfway house, and they used to pay him a part-time job for an 80-year-old guy to disinfect the doorknobs and do some COVID cleanup sort of stuff. He not only lost his place to live at the halfway house, but he lost that little bit of income that he had coming in.
Oh,
he was acquitted. So they continue to punish and try and destroy these men. Mr. Mailman, unfortunately, received a terminal diagnosis 2 months ago, suggesting that he had between 1 and 3 months to live. Nobody knows exactly how long he'll be around. What we do know is it won't be very long. I had lunch with Mr. Mailman in the middle of September, and he was telling me then he's not a large man, but he was telling me he was 165 pounds. When I saw him a week ago, he was 109 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
Man's very difficult to...
Oh, my goodness.
So there'll be no justice for those two men. There'll also be no justice for Mr. Lehman and his family.
Mm-hmm.
The man was murdered. This is not a case where, like my own, where there was no crime that happened. This man was murdered, set on fire, and left to be found by some joggers in a local park. But there'll never be a proper investigation after 40 years into that crime. Most of the police officers, and I'm sure a lot of the witnesses and other players, are not even around anymore. So everyone loses, and that's the specific people who were intimately involved. The people who really lose are the people of New Brunswick and the people of the country. They lose confidence in their justice system. So what we had after working on Innocence Canada, worked on this case for 15 years. As I said, 34 years ago, I was practicing as a jailhouse lawyer and just writing some letters to justice ministers, to lawyers, to journalists, trying to get some traction in their case from the inside, from the prison we were all in. And what happened last week now is the federal justice minister had overturned their convictions, sent it back to the Court of King's Bench in New Brunswick for retrial. We actually held two murder trials within a one-hour period in St. John last week because the Chief Justice came down from Fredericton to hear the matter personally. She called the matter. Mr. Mailman and Mr. Gillespie pled not guilty. The Crown stood up and said they had no evidence to offer. The men were acquitted. And the following day, the Chief Justice issued a written apology to the gentleman.
That's good.
What did not happen, though, Roy, was the Chief of Police for the St. John Police Service or the Attorney General for New Brunswick. They were silent. We were in the media for a week. I did probably 30 interviews, I suppose, and some of them with Canadian press and wire service got picked up by others across the country. Eventually, on Friday, the chief held a little press conference, said that he was going to hire someone to look into what went wrong 40 years ago.
Good, but he stopped short
of offering an apology to Mr. Mailman or Mr. Gillespie.
Ron, I have so to take it.
Essentially, we're left, sorry to drag you along, we're left with the supposition that they don't think there was anything done wrong. So we can only just wait for the next wrongful conviction to come out of St. John, New Brunswick. Yeah. The attitudes haven't changed in 40 years.
Don't go away, Ron. I want to talk to you some more. But what happened to Mr. Mailman and Mr. Gillespie and David Milgaard, in my view, amounts to judicial lynching.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue with that.
I was just thinking here, Ron. You were in the same prison at the same time, and you knew Robert Mailman and Walter Gillespie, who never wavered from in their position that they were innocent, just as David Milgaard did not, just as you did not. So how many more? Do we have any ideas or a guesstimate of how many more not guilty individuals are in prison serving, and I don't want to dismiss anybody, but serving really consequential time?
Innocence Canada is a nonprofit, of course, so we barely have the resources to look at homicide cases. We currently have 125 cases in our office that we're reviewing.
Wow.
75 of those are on a 2 to 3 year wait list. We're trying to work on the other 50 cases. Mr. Mailman pointed out to me when we were driving to court a week ago, Thursday, that there was 20 of us lifers in that particular prison on one particular lifer's range. We were looking for a little quiet area for ourselves, and we had 20 of us there. Of those 20, six have had their convictions overturned as wrongful convictions, including Mr. Mailman and Mr. Gillespie. That's a 30% error.
That's 30%, yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It is crazy.
But I we feel that there's a lot of, I hate to even use the term lesser crimes, but armed robberies, break and enters, all kinds of plea deals that are struck across the country every day in courthouses that are probably wrong. People are so afraid of the system, and the system is so inefficient that people will cop to things that they haven't done.
Do you know what really struck me, Ron, is what you said? That on the day that the Chief Justice of New Brunswick came to hear the case personally, the second trial, as it were, of Mr. Mailman and Mr. Gillespie, the Crown got up and said, first day, we don't have any evidence to present. We recommend you acquit them. This is after they spent 18 and 21 years, respectively, in prison for a murder they did not commit.
Over a 40-year period.
Over a 40-year period.
What happened, of course, is in unraveling their cases and all the time we worked on it, by the time we put the information in front of the federal justice minister and they debunked all of what they were calling evidence, they were left with no real evidence. They never had any evidence.
Yeah, they never had any to begin with. You're right.
They never had
any to begin with.
No, of course.
But they had a target.
Yep. But at the same time that the federal minister overturned their convictions on that basis and the chief justice acknowledged and accepted that there was no evidence, apologized to them for what happened on behalf of the court, we still have the Attorney General in New Brunswick and the Chief of Police in St. John refusing to acknowledge and do the same thing.
Yeah. It's innocencecanada.ca, right, Ron?
It is.
Okay. Yeah. And you can certainly use contributions from any and all of our listeners to help fund your nonprofit and help do the kind of work, certainly, the great work you're doing.
We appreciate every nickel that comes in, and we put it to good use.
I'll send you a few nickels.
Well, thank you, Roy.
No, I think I'm not trying to be funny. It's really tremendously serious. And if everybody contributes a few bucks, we can help some people and some families whose family members were wrongfully convicted.
We only review cases after they've lost their trials and all of their appeals.
Okay.
No place left to turn when we come to
that. We will talk again soon, Ron. Thank you for the time today.
You're welcome, Roy.
Thanks so much.
All the best.
And to you. Last September, we spoke with two young ladies in Toronto. You'll have to forgive me, I'm from a certain generation. Yumna and Khadija Farooq. It was great talking to them. But it was scary talking to them because what they were facing was a rent increase of $7,000, not per year, per month, from their landlord, who could do it because the building was newer, the building they were living in. He wanted to raise it to $3,500 initially from $25,000, as I recall. And Khadija and Yumna sort of asked about that. And so this landlord said, well, if you don't like that, we'll raise it to $9,500 or $114,000 a year. So you'd have to earn $228,000 to just clear enough to pay the rent. Given our tax structure, Yumna and Khadija Farooq join us. How are you both?
Hi, Roy. Nice to connect with you again. I'm not doing too bad considering we got some sunshine today. That was a nice surprise.
Yeah, it's always a nice surprise, particularly when the temperature is really low, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So we talked last September, and I outlined what your situation was. I've been curious, and listeners have actually been in touch with me over the last number of months. I'd get the emails coming in occasionally saying, what happened to the sisters in Toronto and that insane rent increase? How's it gone for you?
Well, Roy, it's been quite a journey. And while we can say that we're fortunate enough to not have landed in the worst case scenario, we were definitely presented with a lot of challenges. We did not, in the end, get to move out to another place. Instead, we are staying with family, friends, and just trying to figure out where we're going next.
Oh,
there's just so much that's up in the air right now. And it's, you know, we wish we could say that it was neatly packaged and there was a perfect solution. But unfortunately, in cases like this, that's not what happens.
No, and it's you know, renting a place these days, and these days, by that I mean in the last 6 months even, has become significantly more expensive and problematic. There's fewer places available, and those that are available are increasingly expensive.
Absolutely.
Yep. And people that are in rent-controlled buildings want to hold on to them for, you know, forever if they could, but that makes it even trickier because everything that's new on the market, the rent, as you said, is just insanely high.
So clearly that previous landlord of yours was not interested in negotiating an agreeable rent, even though you'd been there for a number of years and were good tenants.
Yeah, we just couldn't really make him see reason and in a better and more agreeable decision. It's just, I think it was his subtle way of saying, get out.
Yeah, not so subtle.
Definitely.
Yeah, so you're currently living with friends and family, and you're still looking for an affordable accommodation, right?
Right now, we've suspended that as we're just figuring things out. As you mentioned, we're like, the market is absolutely terrible. The rental market, it's just becoming more difficult for people to be afford to live in this city.
So we're kind of keeping an eye on things and trying to determine what is a good time to like move up or look for places. Is the rent going to come down? You know, also with the housing market being just a general mess, we're just kind of waiting and seeing what's going to happen in the next few months.
That is so tough because, you know, well, I'm not telling you anything you don't know or anybody doesn't know. Shelter and food are the most fundamental needs that we have. And when both of them start to spiral out of control, the impact on individuals and then the broader community is massive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's been the toughest part of it, is just recognizing it, that it's like the fundamental need to have a roof over your head. And that when that's being like taken away or in question, it creates so much stress, so much anxiety, so much panic. It's so difficult.
Yeah, I was hoping you were going to come on and say, we found this great place and it's what we were paying before and we're very happy, but I understand the reality of the situation. What about public support? People became aware of you across the country, certainly in Toronto and beyond. Have you had response? Have people reached out to you, or have you been recognized when you've looked at a rental property and people say, "Oh, I remember you. You were in the news."
We definitely did have people reach out to us and mention that they might have a place. We had a realtor also reach out and offer help in kind. So I think, you know, now that we're not looking, obviously we haven't checked on whether people are reaching out, but at that time when we thought there might be, you know, a chance for us to find a new place, we did find great support in the community.
Yeah. And it was really interesting, going back to a point I made earlier, is when we reached out to the realtor, we weren't able to get anything in our budget. It was slightly higher, but I just remember us saying, it would be great if we could get a rent-controlled building so something like this doesn't happen again, but he wasn't able to find anything. So it's just, yeah, that's what the situation is.
Yeah, we were just talking in the last half hour about the situation Canadians are facing, and the majority of Canadians are facing really significant financial stresses. Do you find and I don't want to probe too much here, but has it been something that's, I don't say depressed, but it has to become a daily a challenge, right? I think, I mean, I would, if I were in your situation, I'd be saying, well, what was wrong with that guy? I was a good tenant. I was paying my rent on time. And all of a sudden, this guy wants $7,000 a month more. He wants $9,500 a month for a two-bedroom apartment. How's he going to rent that? But by the way, have they been able to rent that apartment?
We're not sure. And, you know, I think both of us partly want to warn other people. But at the same time, we don't want to, you know, publicly drag someone's name through the dirt. It is definitely something you don't get over so quickly. And we're probably going to be processing this for years to come to really understand why this happened.
You sound like such, I mean, you sound like such amazing young women. If I had a place that I was renting and you wanted to rent it, I'd lower the rent just to get you.
That's very kind of you to say.
No, it's true. Well, I thank you for coming on. I hope you don't mind. I just wanted to, and I did hear from listeners who wanted to know how you were doing, and mm-hmm. I'm glad you came on. Would you get back in touch with me, please, when it gets to the point where you find something and you're happy with it, because I'd like to talk to you then.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you so much, Yamna and Khadija. You sound like such amazing young women. So I wish you only the very, very best.
Thank you, Roy. Really appreciate it.
I don't know if you've been following what's been going on in Germany. I have, because I was in Switzerland just 2 weeks ago. And the unrest was really starting to grow on the border, across the border in Germany, which has now seen German farmers who are fed up with their federal government. And it began with a concern about the federal government in Germany saying, we're going to reduce the subsidy for diesel fuel for German farmers. That may still be the core issue, although I understand the Berlin government has said, well, we'll phase that in now over 3 years, which has not satisfied the German farmers. They're out blocking streets and highways, basically shutting down the country. That may be an overstatement. My guest will be able to tell us that. But there's also the issue of, what do you call them? Train drivers now, right? It's not engineers anymore. It's people who drive the trains. They are striking as well, and doctors are striking in Germany. Not a good scene. Center-left government, more left than center. And now Mr. Scholz, the chancellor, is trotting out the left's favorite term. Oh, extremists are taking over the farmers' protest. Farmers are farmers. They're not extremists. So we're going to talk about that, and then we're going to find out what the mood is among farmers in this country. So I was curious about what's happening in Germany, and then thinking, because farmers in Canada have said they're fed up with the Trudeau government because of the carbon tax and because of their fertilizer initiatives. Fertilizer is bad for the climate, says Mr. Trudeau and his sidekick, the Environment Minister, Guy Boll. But let's talk about what's going on in Germany. Our good friend, and she's very good to this program, Katja Heuer. Katja is a German-British journalist, visiting research fellow at King's College in London. She writes op-eds for leading international journals. And her new book, Beyond the Wall, A History of East Germany, 1949 to 1990, is doing spectacularly internationally. How are you, Katja?
Yeah, I'm great, Roy. It's superb to be back.
Yeah, congratulations on the book.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I'm very, very pleased with the way that that's read internationally. So that's put East Germany back on the map, I'd say.
Yeah, for an entire generation, it's, what's East Germany? But it is,
yeah,
right?
people tell me all the time they wish they knew more about it. So yeah. Hopefully there's now an opportunity to find out more.
It's a great book. So talk to us, please, about the German farmers who are blocking roads, blocking highways, blocking cities with tractors. It looks like a national endorsement for John Deere, challenging the Scholz government. This isn't just about diesel fuel rebates, is it?
No, I don't think it is. I think that's the trigger, really. That's kind of sparked these latest demonstrations and sort of gatherings of farmers. But really, they've been saying for years that they can't work under the current conditions as it is. They're not making enough money. I mean, those that aren't self-employed, so those who basically work in the sector, they are on about 19,000 euros a year. That's way below average income. In fact, it's kind of on a par with minimum wage pretty much. So, you know, it's basically economically unsustainable as it is. And now that the government has basically tried to remove some of the existing tax cuts on diesel and vehicles, that's sort of, you know, given the last little spark to what was already quite a tinderbox of disaffection with the government.
Yeah, I don't want to pigeonhole anybody, but I think that farmers might be the least likely people to demonstrate, as the German farmers are, because they're so busy doing what they're doing. They work from sun up until well after sundown most days. It's a difficult, difficult job. So we also had a situation where the vice chancellor of Germany was blocked from stepping off a ferry while returning to Germany from vacation. To do that really has to me anyway, it signifies a massive anger. And talk to us about that, please.
Yeah, I mean, that was hugely controversial precisely because, as you say, he was on holiday on a little island in the North Sea, presumably thinking he could kind of get away from it all over Christmas and New Year, and that just wasn't happening because effectively on the way back, his ferry was not just blocked from landing on the mainland, but also nearly sort of stormed by the people demonstrating there. And it was only a small group, around 300 or so. But there was a real fear, you know, around the security of the minister on board, Robert Habeck. So that's been condemned pretty much wholesale, I think, in terms and words that weren't particularly helpful. So the Minister for Agriculture, for example, so the person actually responsible for this sector, spoke of the wet dreams of uprisings that are going through the heads of some people and called the people who were there fanatics. And whilst that, you know, one could argue about the rights and wrongs of the method of protest that they've chosen there, I don't think language like that is helpful. It's going to inflame the situation further, and I think it has.
Yeah, wet dreams of fanatics. That'll settle people down right away. What's the public opinion generally in Germany? So you have the German people who are really disrupted by all of these tractors everywhere, blocking roads, blocking cities. But the German people also support, I would imagine, their farmers. So where's public support coming down?
Well, I think it's, on the whole, people seem to be more positive about this kind of thing compared to, sort of climate activist action where they stick themselves to roads or kind of, smear tomato soup over paintings and things like that. Because people realize, I think, there's a genuine kind of almost existential fear of the farmers behind this. You know, they simply cannot work under the conditions that they currently face economically. And I think people understand that it's not just the farmers themselves, but also, this is about food security, about making sure that agriculture and food production is sustainable in the long run. And I think because of that, people feel it's directly to do with them and not just with the farmers themselves, which is why support's higher. And it's interesting to look over to the Netherlands, for example, where these kinds of protests have been going on since 2019. And I think there was the hope by the Dutch government that they would eventually stop because of the lack of public support. But in fact, the people are largely still behind those demonstrations, even though they've been going on for so long and have been quite disruptive. And as you mentioned at the beginning, other sectors are striking too. So I think there's a genuine feeling that something isn't working quite right. And that's why people can sympathize with the farmers.
So where's this going? Gotcha. You're right. It started with the farmers in the Netherlands. It actually probably started with the Freedom Convoy of truckers to Ottawa, which resonated in Europe. But where's this going in Europe?
I mean, that's a good question because the government has already tried to row back a little bit in that it's taken one of the two measures back. The vehicle tax exemption is kind of back in place. And the tax on diesel has been sort of staggered, as you said at the beginning, over a few years. But I think even if they were to roll back those measures completely, I think the sort of genie is out of the bottle a little bit with this in the sense that, this is anger that has been boiling under the surface for years. As you say, farmers are incredibly busy people. This is also not just a job to them, but a whole lifestyle, often over generations. So they're not necessarily easily moved into action like this. But I think once it's, kind of unleashed something and they gain a sense of, being heard, a sense of satisfaction of getting their problems across finally because they now have a public forum. I don't really see this subsiding anytime soon unless something seriously changes, because ultimately the problem is still there that you have a government that is trying to implement action on climate change very quickly, which also makes farming more difficult and more expensive without actually supporting the farmers at the same time. And that conundrum isn't going to go away anytime soon, I don't think.
Yeah. It's the potential for wider unrest in Europe is very clear. Katja, thank you so much. The book Beyond the Wall, A History of East Germany, 1949 to 1960, by our guest, Katja Heuer. Thank you, Katja.
Thank you. Auf Wiedersehen.
Auf Wiedersehen, yeah. I was speaking Schweizerdeutsch when I was in Switzerland 2 weeks ago. So here I am talking to Swiss people as I'm talking to you with my Canadian accent. And then I switch into Schweizerdeutsch with no trace of an accent, any Canadian accent. I sound like somebody from the city of Bern, which is where I lived
which
until I was 14.
Means I wouldn't understand you anymore. So.
No, you wouldn't. Absolutely, you wouldn't. People ask me, would German people understand what you're saying? I said, maybe one word out of five. Thank you, Katja.
Thank you.
The farmers in this country have expressed their unhappiness with the Trudeau government's including and increasing the carbon tax on their farm operations, as well as the government's determination to interfere with fertilizer use on Canada's farms, directly affecting farmers' ability to grow products and create an income. They work very hard. So how frustrated are Canada's farmers? And might they at some point express that frustration level in a very public manner? We're joined by Gunter Johum, president of the Western Canadian Wheat Growers. Mr. Johum, thank you for taking the time.
No problem, Roy.
So how frustrated are Canada's farmers with the current reality? And let's start with carbon tax.
We're extremely frustrated. you know, the Uyghurs have been made aware of the carbon tax right out of the gate when it was only quietly talked about. And we've warned about this, how disruptive it would be to our incomes and to our farms. And now it's going whole hog, as in they're increasing it every year all the way to $170 a ton. And currently, I think this year will be around $65 a ton. And this on my farm, which is not really a really large farm, right now that is costing me around that $40,000 a year of unrealized income. And it's not a line item, but it definitely, that is the cost that incurs on my farm. And it's just going to escalate from there. And then this fall, there was a Bill C-234 was a carve-out proposed for fuel to heat barns and for grain drying. And the government went out of their way to block that all the way along, right through the Senate. I say there was political interference. It's very frustrating indeed.
$40,000 is a lot of money. And the government says, but it's all revenue neutral. You get it back. You don't have to worry about it. We'll take it. But we'll give it back to you. And as Brad Wall said when he was the Premier of Saskatchewan, when he was talking to Justin Trudeau, so what's the point? You're taking money, you're giving it back. Are they giving it back to you? You're getting it all back?
No, we're not getting it all back. You know, as a family, as a consumer, personally, I give back, $260 every, a couple times a year. The farm, at the farm level, we're able to apply for a some kind of a fuel rebate that is tied to the carbon tax. And last year we got a rebate that was right around that $2,000 mark.
So you're out about $35,000.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's a lot of money for a farm.
That's a lot of money, and it's only going to get worse because the carbon tax will inflate up to $174 a ton.
Yeah.
Right now we're at $65. So by the time we reach that, it will be close to $140,000. And that, in the government's word of using the word sustainable, is not sustainable.
No, I would imagine that would cause certain farms, many farms, to close.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So here's the question then. And we just talked about the German farmers who are furious with their government and blocking city streets and highways and such. And our guest, Katja Heuer, told us largely the German people are supportive of their farmers. Are Canada's farmers close to, or are they sufficiently frustrated with what you've just described to engage in a public protest, perhaps like the one being engaged in Germany?
Roy, we're not at that stage yet, but I sure hope we don't need to get to that stage. But you never know. You know, the truckers staged a protest last spring, and it ended badly for many of them. And there's still people suffering from that peaceful demonstration. And farmers don't want to do that. Like Canadian farmers and Canadians in general, you know, we say sorry a lot and often, and we're very, reserved people. And so we don't want to resort to that. But if our backs are pushed right up against the wall with no way out, and the government keeps coming at us and wanting more and taking more, well, who knows what will happen, right? It's not good. So I sure hope we don't get to the stage that the Dutch farmers and now the German farmers are at.
So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you're not saying it's impossible.
Well, you never know. You know, the week.
I mean, survival, right? Is it survival for you?
Yeah. It is survival. And as an organization, and I'm president of the Wheat Growers, I'm not calling on our members to go and stage a strike like this. But if it comes down to survival, you know, who knows what will happen. We are, and I stress again, I will not ask my members to step to that kind of retaliation against the government. We as a group, we lobby our government. We lobby the opposition. We talk to people like yourself. We talk to consumers and make everybody aware. And so it might not even be the farmers that do the protesting. It might be just regular consumers, mm-hmm. right? I'm a consumer as well, right? I go to the store to buy my groceries. And,
but, Mr. Yohum, I only have a few seconds here. But without the farmers, we lose a lot of what we need as consumers. You lose your farm. There's a fine line here. And I think the government is... I'm just sharing my point of view in 5 seconds. The government's on that line, and they can't afford to cross it. Yes or no? Yeah? No?
Right.
Okay.
They can't afford to cross it.
We'll talk again. Thank you, Mr. Yohum. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.